The cords of death encompassed me. The torrents of destruction assailed me. The cords of Sheol entangled me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears. Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations also of the mountains trembled and quaked because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him. Thick clouds dark with water. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through his clouds. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. And he sent out his arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightnings and routed them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He rescued me from my strong enemy and from those who hate me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. That was a reading from Psalm 18, and you are listening to Theophilus Theologue, an informal theology podcast, and we have reached episode 6. Apologies for the long delay between episodes, but we are, this episode does follow on from the last episode, where we began to try to creep up on a theology of darkness, and there's just more to say, so we're going to keep talking about a theology of darkness for a few more episodes. In the last episode, I think we fairly clearly saw a theology of darkness in terms of the creation and in terms of the fall, which is leaving me wondering whether there is a theology of darkness that relates then to redemption. That's not the only way to kind of outline a theology of something, but it's a tried and true way that certainly works. It's not the final way to look at the contours of theology, but a creation, fall, and redemption, and all that redemption means with recreation, new creation, and so forth, I think is it's a useful way, at least to, attack things from a certain angle and so forth. So in looking at those kinds of contours, we can then think about, well, what about darkness in terms of redemption? In the creation, we saw, of course, that, there was darkness over the face of the deep as the Holy Spirit hovered there at the moment of creation, just before God says, let there be light. And then, of course, even as God creates light, he makes both day and night. He created the night. He created the night time to be part of his good order of things. Because, this is in Genesis chapter 1, where all of creation at the end of it and at the beginning of chapter 2 and so forth is pronounced as very good. So this is a sense of, I think, that the Bible gives us of a good darkness that's in creation, that is part of how God ordered it, okay? And it's separated out from the light, so that you have light and darkness in their proper places under God's lordship and these sorts of things. So I think that theme comes up again a number of times in the Bible, where there's mention of nocturnal animals, and this isn't in a threatening way to represent evil or whatever, but simply talking about the creation order and these sorts of things. But of course, the predominant note about darkness in particular, and also of night in the Bible, is that it represents sinfulness and evil and ways opposed to God. You get that in the paths of darkness that you find in Proverbs and in the New Testament with the people of God, followers of Christ, being called children of light and of day, who are not, it says, of night or of darkness, and these sorts of things. So, you know, there's a fallen darkness as well. There's an important theology of darkness that limbs that sort of evil that is represented by darkness throughout the Bible. And admittedly, that's probably the main way that it's used, but it's not, I really think we can see here that it's not the only way that it's used. And so, moving on from that, there's just two main images I want to look at this time when we're asking ourselves, well, what about redemption? How about darkness and redemption? And those two images are God himself as the storm rider who cloaks himself in darkness that we see in the Psalms, and the other one being the covenant God who comes to Abraham and, as it literally says, apparently, in the Hebrew, he comes and cuts his covenant with Abraham, that we'll see in Genesis 15, and Abraham experiences a horror and great darkness, as the text says, when God comes near in this way. So, some interesting things going on there. Beginning with this image of God sort of wrapping himself in darkness. And the first thing I would point to there is actually from 1 Kings chapter 8, where the temple has just been completed, and Solomon gives a speech and says a prayer and so forth. And one of the things that he says, because the presence of God has come to the temple, and there's the cloud of his glory, so powerful and present that they can't even go on with the rituals for the time being. And Solomon says that, the Lord has said that he would dwell in thick darkness. The Lord, Yahweh, the holy God, who's creator of all things and redeemer, says that he will dwell in thick darkness. And of course, this is probably coming from images of God at Mount Sinai with Moses and so forth. And his glory sometimes manifests itself in this sense of thick darkness. What's going on there? I mean, could that, I just cannot see how that could fit with the other more predominant metaphors of darkness that where it represents sin and evilness and a place of sin and evil. A place that goes away from God. I mean, this is the opposite of that. This is God's presence arrived, and yet he is dwelling, as it says, in thick darkness. So I think this must again be something of that creational goodness, still attendant upon the Creator at times when he makes his presence known. So, for example, we have Psalm 18 that I read from at the beginning of this podcast, and where God is very powerfully depicted as cloaking himself in darkness and riding upon the thick darkness. And that, you know, later in that psalm, interestingly, the psalmist says that when God comes to him, he lightens my darkness, or illumines the darkness, as some translations say. So God comes in darkness, but not to convey ultimately a darkness upon his people in any negative sense, but rather to illumine their darkness. And yet he wraps himself in a certain kind of darkness. You see this again in Psalm 97. There's thick darkness all around him. A very similar picture is drawn. But again, this darkness can't be that of sin or evil. In Psalm 97, the very next phrase in the psalm says that righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. So, you know, affirming God's righteousness and justice being foundational to his reign, to his majesty, to his sovereignty. And so there, he's not going to wrap himself in unrighteousness and injustice. This darkness must be somehow resonant with that. And Psalm 104 is a different take on the same sort of image, where it says the psalmist says to God, covering yourself with light as with a garment. But yet it's the same sort of imagery going on. He makes the clouds his chariot, it says there, and there's thunder and lightning and so forth. And so it's either a different shot, it's a different sort of angle on the same manifestation type imagery, because you can see light through the lightning and fire and so forth happening even in these darkness pictures. So possibly he's just looking at it that way and emphasizing the light, or it's a complementary variation on that kind of manifestation of God, where this time instead of darkness he wraps himself in light, and yet the darkness is there as well in the clouds, just like it is in the other two psalms. So there's this picture of God. In fact, this is definitely, as you look at the whole of the literature, a picture of God as divine warrior. And of course, this thick darkness that he cloaks himself in these images, wouldn't be sin or evil. And yet, it would be scary. Particularly, it's scary to the enemies of God. Okay? Because how this relates to redemption is that in each of these cases, God is coming down from the heavens, as the imagery goes, wrapping himself in darkness. For what purpose? He is coming to rescue. He is coming to re rescue his beloved child. He is the divine warrior and king come to rescue his people. He is the divinely wrathful father coming to rescue his child from harmful evil forces out to destroy that child. Okay, so this is a scary image, but it's scary to the enemies of God, who are overpowering and oppressing his beloved children. So, whilst it is a sight of terror to the enemies of God, who would oppose all his righteous and just ways and instead pursue unrighteousness and injustice and oppress people made in his image, it is scary and a terror to those aligning themselves against God in this way. For those who are trusting in God and counting upon his righteousness to make them righteous, and humbly walking with him, endeavoring to live in that same righteousness, to those, this awesome, terrible picture of God is actually a sight of joy, because it means we are being rescued by a God who, in his divine and holy darkness, as it were, and how he wraps himself in that holy darkness, he is greater than any evil darkness in this world. He trumps it, and trumps it decisively. And it reminds me of a wonderful saying from G.K. Chesterton in an essay of his, I believe, called The Red Angel, where he's talking about fairy tales and their use and purpose. And I think I'm going to quote from it more extensively in the next episode. But in it, he says that fairy tales, what he's talking about there, reveal to us that our enemies have enemies in the knights of God. And it's really w a wonderful saying, and as from the context, it's even more wonderful. But I think you can grasp it just from that little line of it. Our enemies have enemies in the knights of God. Knight, in the knights of God. And I think that's what this psalm is bringing across, that there is, as terrifying and horrifying as evil can seem sometimes in the darkness that surrounds us, God is more terrifying than that darkness, not by being more evil, but by being more good, by being good, the one true good in this world. The one who could never be sullied by evil, the one who is righteous. And that righteousness is always going to be a terror to everything that is evil, but a joy and a source of hope and rejoicing for those who are trusting in his goodness. I don't say, the ones who are also good, like God, and who have chosen not to be evil, because in the biblical story, everyone's infected with sin and with evil. We have all made that decision against this good God, and we all find ourselves on the on the enemy side of God, and the seeing him as a terror to us because he's so good and beautiful, and we have rebelled against all of that and become evil and opposed to his goodness. But what I'm talking about is then through his grace, his offering of salvation to any who will trust in him, his willingness to pay a price to cleanse those who are in sin and evil, who are in that kind of darkness, and bring them as the you know, speaking of a theology of darkness, in terms of redemption, you know, in terms of darkness being evil, the New Testament, for example, often says things about God bringing us out of darkness into his light, into his marvelous light, and these sorts of things. So I'm saying those people who are trusting in God in that way and have experienced that transfer from evil darkness into his light, they may look at God coming in rescue, in the cloaking himself in a holy darkness, and rejoice. Not because they're so good, but because they have trusted the goodness that God has conferred upon them through the price that he has paid in Jesus Christ and his cross. But those who refuse that, they would be the ones terrified of his approach in this way. So here's God coming in redemption in quite an intense sort of imagery of him wrapping himself in a very voluble, ferocious sort of darkness, flaming and lightning and what have you. So that's one image, and I think that is an image of good darkness. And it's not, you know, this goes back to our theology of wildness that we looked at several episodes ago. You know, it's not safe. You know, I'm reminded that I didn't even mention Aslan from the Chronicles of Narnia in my theology of wildness episode, which I meant to. Of course, I talked about Jesus as the Lion of Judah and so forth, but, you know, Lewis's depiction of Aslan and the things that are said about him in the Chronicles of Narnia is a classic example, you know, of a theology of wildness, how Aslan is said to not be a tame lion, and that when the children ask, is he safe? You know, and Mr. Beaver says, of course he's not safe. Are you listening to what I'm saying? He's a lion. He's not safe, but he does say he's good. He's not safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you, is what Mr. Beaver says. That's the key here, is that, you know, this picture of God is not going to make us feel, you know, cozy about, hey, God's cute, put him in our back pocket, you know. He's my co-pilot. That stupid saying, where did that ever come from? And these cheesy things and cutesy stuff and, you know, Christian t-shirts and whatever, you know, God breaks outside of those kitschy, horrible depictions and so forth, in many ways, but this being one way and one sort of imagery the Bible gives us to remind us he is awesome and holy, and he's not safe, you know, but he is good. He's good. So what he does is righteous, and wise and just and so forth. But he comes and, you know, he wraps himself in this darkness, as we see depicted here. And he does so to bring salvation, to rescue from evil. And that is one image to look at in terms of a theology of darkness and redemption. Now, another quieter, but equally haunting image would be Genesis 15, and it's a crucial chapter in the Bible, one that's referenced a number of times in the New Testament, quite crucially about salvation, where God makes himself present to Abraham, but this time, instead of this intense imagery that we've just seen in the Psalms, he comes in a vision. He comes with assurance and comfort, and the first words out of his mouth are, "Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward will be very great." And then this conversation ensues between Abraham and God, Yahweh, where, you know, Abraham wants to trust God and his promises to him, but he's confused and he's weak and he's unsure and so forth. So he's asking him questions, because God has promised that he will have an heir through his barren wife, and they're both old now, and so forth and so on. But God reassures him, yes, you are going to have an heir from your own body, because this is important to God's promises to bless the whole world through Abraham's line, which is ultimately a messianic a promise. Okay, so this is really the promise of Christ, ultimately. And as Abraham is coping with this promise and trying to listen to what God says to him and trust him, it says in verse 5 that God brought Abraham outside. Brought him outside. And what time of day is it? Well, it says he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them, so shall your offspring be. And so it's God comes to Abraham in the night. See, the night is not just a realm of evil. It can be a realm of God's glory, as we said last time in looking at Psalm 19, and how as well as day, night reveals the knowledge and glory of God. And God comes to Abraham in the night and tells him to look up at the night sky to in order to understand him and to trust him and so forth. This is God graciously moving in Abraham's life, and he does so at night and says, look up at the stars. And when he did, it says that Abraham believed the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him as righteousness. And this is one of the main things that gets picked up in the New Testament, reminding us that we are made righteous by our faith in God and trusting in his promises and trusting in his Messiah. And from there, Abraham is still is believing and trusting and having this awesome righteousness conferred upon him through faith, and yet he still wants to know. He still pursues knowledge, as Proverbs tells us to pursue knowledge. And he asks God, how am I to know that I'll possess this land you tell me I'm going to possess, and my people will, and so forth. And so that's where we come into this wonderfully numinous scene where God says to Abraham in verse 9, bring me a heifer, a female goat, a ram, all of these 3 years old, turtle dove, pigeon, etc. And Abraham brings them before God, and he cuts them in half and lays the halves to either side. Okay, so quite a macabre, interesting picture going on there already. And Abraham has to chase the carrion birds of prey coming down on the carcasses, because this takes a while. This is a period of time. Presumably it's already gone into another whole day from when he spoke to him at night, because then in verse 12 it says, as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. Okay, so again, God doing his work in the night. Okay, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Or as some translations say, horror and great darkness fell upon Abraham. Horror and great darkness, as God is coming to him to assure him, to give him knowledge, to make him understand and believe the promises that he gives him of the Messiah. He comes to him in horror and great darkness. That is significant. That is interesting. This can't be a darkness of evil and sin that God would come to Abram in. This is a holy darkness where God is making himself known to him. And the Lord says to him, as this horror and great darkness falls upon him, he says, know for certain that your offspring will. And then he lays out what's going to happen in Egypt and how they'll be oppressed, but then be rescued and so forth and so on. So he gives them details of the future. Know for certain this. And then finally in verse 17, when the sun had gone down, and it was dark. Only at this time, in this darkness. When it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces, these cut up animals. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Or in the Hebrew, the Lord cut a covenant with Abraham, or Abram, and saying, to your offspring, I give this land. So God cuts his covenant with Abraham in this very strange and beautifully numinous and dark setting. God is at work assuring, making his covenant with Abraham, assuring him of the promises, ultimately of the Messiah to come. And so, in these images, I think we see then how theology of darkness works itself out in terms of redemption. God is at work in the darkness and using a holy darkness to make his presence known in rescuing and in making a covenant and in making known his promises of the Messiah and so forth. And so it seems to me that the Bible clearly shows that darkness is associated not only with evil, but with the good creation and with good redemption, with covenant faithfulness and so on. And God makes himself known in this. I mean, you see, as Abraham asks for knowledge and God says no for certain, you're seeing sort of a almost a dark epistemology going on there. John Wesley, commenting on this Genesis 15 passage, says that holy fear prepares the soul for holy joy. And, you know, that's what the Proverbs say. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. So part of this darkness is to indeed to produce a fear in us, but a holy fear of God, a respect and awe for him, a trust in him, and so forth. And God works through that. So I think we'll stop there for this episode. And there's a few other things I want to say for the next episode, because there's just one more area, and maybe it's the most controversial, that I want to look at in terms of a theology of darkness, about God himself, the Trinitarian God, and darkness, and whether there's a holy darkness, in a sense, even within God. But suffice it to say that God is working through the night and through darkness for redemption, and that the night proclaims the gospel of God, the gospel of Christ, even as the day does. And that's why Jeremiah in chapter 34, the Lord promises that if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that day and night no longer come at their appointed times, which is what we looked at last time, that God appoints night and darkness, then my covenant with David, my servant, can be broken, and I won't give him a descendant on the throne, which is again a messianic promise. And he's saying, look, I've made a covenant not only with the day, but with the night. And as long as that night proceeds, we can, every night can happen. And just as with the daytime, we can go, oh, God is going to keep his promise. God is going to work out all his plans and purposes through the Christ. And we see that in the night as much as we see it in the day. So thank you for listening, and we shall talk about some more in the next episode.